morning, everyone. I'm glad to be here today talking to you. So I want to keep it a little bit interactive. You know what I like thought, whatever I can fit in the talk, I will fit in. We'll see how much time we have, how much we can get done. There are like some slides that I put in hidden, like if we have time, then I can go over them. I get the idea you have already been exposed in some of the topics that I will talk about, but it doesn't hurt to go over them and see if you want to learn more about them. To begin with, Latham gave a talk yesterday, I assume, on cosmology and early universe. Can somebody like give me a quick summary of what topics you heard from him?
Well, he went over the standard model.
Okay, good. It's particle physics. Okay, anything about
this? What about the fate of the universe? The beginning of the universe.
I assume he mentioned bounce universes, or he did? Okay, we will cover a little. What about inflation? Okay, so we will go over some of those, basically a lot of those things. I try to give you a little bit more details picture. And just tell me if I'm going too slow or too fast, and let me know. We can stop and change the pace. Okay. So as many of you by now must have realized, cosmology is basically a field which, in one hand, you're connected to observations, a particular kind of observation, cosmos, space, astrophysics. And on the other hand, your job is to connect math and fundamental theories to this observation. So you are in a unique situation, as everything you build up have to make these two guys friends with each other. So let us start with the very basic thing, where maybe like an origin of the modern cosmology started with Hubble, I would say, at some level. Which is that we realized that early on in 20th centuries that galaxies are just getting further and further away from each other. And that gave us an indication that our space is expanding on very large scales. Obviously not solar system and that kind of a scale, but when we go further, very, very, very large scales, things are getting far away. And that naturally means that if I go further in the past, then things must have been closer and closer to each other. And even though this picture looks like a close, I'm using a balloon cartoon to demonstrate that, it doesn't mean our universe is like a balloon necessarily. What we mean is just everything. It could still be infinitely large, but every piece of it that you take will get, as you go further and further in the past, will get more and more compact, and things in that piece will get closer and closer. Because sometimes as we get further, we get to the Big Bang picture and everything, sometimes people I hear have the impression that everything started from the point. Well, what it means is that everything that we're in with a large piece of universe that we observe started from the point, but it doesn't mean the whole space-time was a point. It means it could still be very infinitely large in the beginning. Does that make sense? Okay, and then as things get closer and closer, further in back, what you expect is that energy in that volume gets larger and larger, energy density, temperature gets hotter, so things will start to change. The physics will change. You get a hotter, like hot soup of particle physics, that mechanism, interaction, everything will change as you go further in past. And in what we like to, like a very important function that we use in cosmology to parameterize expansion is this A thing. Basically it tells you, like today, for example, if I scale the distances by this A and I take it to be one, and then I go back, that sort of parameterizes how small things are getting. So everything, how much smaller this piece of universe was compared to today would be determined by this function. And then the rate of the change, because it's time dependent, it could be, for example, changing like T itself linearly, or it could have different, due to the different things that you put in the universe, as we see matter and geometry are related. Then we parameterize the range, the rate of it, often through its first derivative. And this dot is time derivative with respect to the A itself. So it's like a, when we call that Hubble rate, due to astronomer Hubble, who first basically measured this parameter. And every time we measure H, we have a sense of how fast things are expanding. And it's a quick calculation for you, which I leave it as an exercise for you. If things are scaling or expanding with a speed A, with a scale A, you can show the velocity, relative velocity of two objects is proportional to their distance times this H. It's pretty quick. You can manage it yourself. So then you can see, for example, today, if we do measure astrophysical distances and their velocities, we can determine the value of H. That gives us an idea of how fast the universe is expanding. If we can do this measurement earlier in the past, we measure Hubble rate further in the past, and that gives us an idea of what happened in early universe. Okay, now with all that, now we go ahead and do all of our observation, different kind of observation. And our job is basically to build up the whole history of the universe. So we have in this, this is a famous figure with WMAP satellite team put out. It's like a cartoon of the history of the universe. So we have, for example, this WMAP, one of the major satellites in 21st centuries to who measured cosmic microwave background, which I hear you have learned a little bit about it, right? That was like a breakthrough in measurement of those anisotropies. It measures that all the way from here. But from there to there, you see most of the history of the universe consists of other things, like larger scale structures, galaxies, when the first planets were formed, first stars somewhere, or is it not here? Yeah, first stars here. And this whole like 13.7 billion years, most of it is really this part when matter dominated our universe, what we call matter or baryonic matter, in fact, dark matter, everything else was determining how this expansion was happening, how A was changing, how H was changing. So due to measurement of this, for example, we have a good handle on determining the expansion history. Again, like now, look at the balloon as if it's the size of this, but as I go in the further in the past, it will become smaller and smaller and smaller. And depending on which matter density is more important, that will change how this A function is changing. Any question here? Okay, so let's take a quick review of what we know due to our observation, both this CMB, cosmic microwave background, which is coming from very, very far away in past to today, and this measurement of all the distribution of galaxies and other larger scale structure. So we have a good handle how much there are, each of them, because, for example, the temperature of cosmic microwave background tells us exactly how much photons we have in the universe. Or when we measure the galaxy surveys, we get an idea how much baryonic matter we have. And as we said, as I said before, things get hotter and hotter as I go further past, and then there is a time when photons and all the matter get so much mixed up that photons cannot travel freely to us anymore. So we don't see anything beyond this surface, basically. This is the time beyond which they were so mixed up to each other that photons would like get scattered from everything else. So everything, the furthest picture that we have from the universe, early universe, is this picture, which is still very impressive, because look at this timeline. Billions of years, And this is only 400 years, right? So the fact that we managed to get a picture from very, very early time to very perfect accuracy by itself is quite impressive. So what do we think happened before that is basically the topic of my talk. Like, how these things, which in a way, this anisotropy is on this cosmic microwave background, are telling us about initial conditions of the universe. And I get into it a little bit further. It maps quite accurately to gravitational field in our universe back then, because those anisotropies and gravitational fields by itself were the ones that became the seeds of all these larger scale structures. So everything we see today, galaxies, things like that, were seeded at this point already. So I have a picture from that, I have an idea about like what was the initial condition for universe. If I change that, then everything in this picture will change. So how did they came to be is one of the big questions. And from the theoretical side, I know the universe because of the components it had, and as we see, matter and geometry were connected, must have been contracting or like expanding before that, which means it would have been getting smaller and smaller. And then I can make some predictions or some have some ideas of what kind of things would have happened here. For example, we think these seeds, this initial condition, were produced through some quantum mechanism, quantum fluctuations. We know that the theory of GR would have broken down, as we see in a second, or probably even breaks down with some of these scenarios that we have. So let's get a little bit into that picture. Right, so just to give you a couple of ideas, some of the big questions in cosmology today are concerning these three questions. What happened here, which is what I'm going to talk about, dark matter, which I assume you got a little bit of that, and another big puzzle in cosmology, modern cosmology today, is related to the fact that expansion is accelerating. This is a new discovery. Think about a decade ago. It got a Nobel in 4 or 5 years ago, which we managed to figure out. And in fact, contrary to all the expectation from the beginning, against all our particle physics intuition, gravitational intuition, universe is doing something very strange. Its expansion is accelerating. I don't want to get into that now, but that's a big puzzle in itself and very interesting history of its own. So a lot of work in today's cosmology are concerned to these three puzzles. Again, some of the maybe words that we might hear, the things that I'm going to talk about, Big Bang singularity, quantum fluctuation, basically generating seeds of larger scale structure. The key words maybe you hear, inflation, bounce, quantum gravity, some new theories like what I guess Leighton was talking about for particle physics. And the observation, on the other hand, which should match these theories that we build up, CMB, matter power spectrum galaxy surveys, the statistical properties of them. And more recently, we are hoping to also match gravitational waves, maybe information. Maybe at some point we get also something similar to the photons that we have cosmic microwave background. Maybe next generation of observation will give us neutrino backgrounds that we can measure. There's a lot of activity on that front as well. Then the intermediate time, dark matter mostly, and its alternatives that people are working, modified Newtonian dynamics, some relativistics counterparts that are trying to see whether they work as good as dark matter or not. Similarly, we can measure the properties of dark matter through galaxy curves, which was first a hint to the fact that things are not quite fitting and some matter must be missing. Nowadays, we have lensing signals. Gravity can bend the light as it comes to us and give us an idea of where the matter, dark matter could be, CMB itself. And then they're trying to answer questions like that. How did the first stars form, galaxies form, the reionization era when universe started to get ionized, and that kind of world. And as I mentioned, the last puzzles are usually this called cosmological constant problem. I suggest you go read about this because it's a funny story about how Einstein thought he made a mistake in his equations. But it turns out now that he's long gone, he might have not made a mistake. Maybe it's there, that constant in his equation should be there. And it's related to dark energy and late time acceleration of universe. Okay, so let's focus on early time. On this picture. So we have two kind of ways to get an idea from observational front. What are we looking for? What should our theory fit in? One from the photons, cosmic microwave background. One from the galaxies. Both of these have to be rooted in the same initial condition in gravity. Because if like I had a space-time which was completely homogeneous, this surface would have just one particular temperature, one temperature. Yes.
What does that word mean, the first
word, anisotropy? I could have made a typo there or something. Is that anisotropy means so if you have something is perfectly uniform, right? It's homogeneous. But on top of that, if you have a small variations, that I call anisotropies. So what we see basically when we do the cosmic microwave observation. Again, it's a funny story how it was discovered because people had predicted it from Big Bang Theory, but the people who discovered it had no idea they are discovering it, and they ended up winning the Nobel for that. So in the space, when you do the observation, there is some very, very small temperature around 2.7 Kelvin, which is close to zero, but not quite, homogeneous and uniformly in every direction in a space, in vacuum, like we make an observation, obviously away from sun and everything. And that's very uniformly, just one temperature everywhere, like a Planck thermal distribution. But then on top of that, there are small variations, which are this picture tries to give you that idea. Like some places are slightly hotter, some places are slightly cooler. And that variation is one in 100,000, like one is that 10 to the minus 5. Like it's extremely small. Still, that's the impressive part. We go and measure that with satellites. And then we can turn it into math. And this is called like two-point function for a statistical properties of this map. So for those very, very small fluctuations and variation, we managed to extract some map. And this map is telling us what must have happened in the beginning of the universe. Is that cool or not? So for example, this give you some ideas. Like the position of this first peak in this plot tells us the size of the universe at that, like size of the what we observe today at that time, at early time. The ratio of these peaks tell us how much photon versus baryon we had at that area, and so on. It's extremely interesting. So this is like I'm just trying to give you a sense of you measure this, which is so this variation, again, you can do the same thing with larger scale structure, with the distribution of galaxies and clusters of galaxies and all of that. And you can turn it again into some plot and some mathematical statistical property. And the two of them, because they're coming from the same initial condition, they have to match each other at very early time, the spectrum of them. That's what the terminology we call usually power spectrum. So we turn this variation fluctuation into a formula, same thing here. Both of them should match the variation of gravitational potential at very, very early time. And that's what I'm calling zeta. People call, you might come across curvature perturbation. That means curvature variation of a space at very early time. So you turn that into that. From both of these plots, they have to match each other. And this is, again, on cosmological scales, not a small scale like solar system. We are talking about 1 megaparsec to 3,000 megaparsec in today's distances. And then we track it back in the past, so it would have been a smaller past, but today it's very large. So then Einstein gravity, the Einstein equations, relativity, what that tells us is what I have here exactly. A space-time geometry curvature should be related to matter. Does that make sense? And yeah, I wanted to do this separately. And just to give you an idea, this is the latest release of data from last week. The most accurate picture of that map in cosmic microwave background. And this is the mathematical term. If you go to the papers they published with this, this just came around last week from Planck satellite, which is right now doing the most up, I guess, the forefront of this measurement. So we have been doing it, like first there was COBE, which you look, it's funny, you go through the pictures that you get. It's first it was the COBE satellite, which is, was very fuzzy, like here, like it's like a very low resolution picture. Then WMAP, which I showed you, did the better picture. And now we are dealing with this one, which is extremely accurate. Okay, so my job as a theorist is to explain this picture that I just showed you, right? So then I go back to gravity and look at the equations. And I see that universe was before, must have been going smaller and smaller. So I look at this scale and the statistical properties of them and I see, oh, wait a minute. There is a particular property, which I'm going to call a scale invariant, which basically means powers on different scales seems to be the same in cosmic microwave background and the same with large scale structure. So there is this particular property. The temperature, the background temperature on different scales seems to be the same on CMB, both like 2.7 to the main one, the uniform background. So there must have been a relation between different points in cosmic microwave background. So I put my equation and go back and say, okay, what would have happened before the light came to us? I track back those scales. And while I do that, I look at the equation and I see universe was getting more and more compact. So radiation density was going up, matter density was going up, and boom, they are blowing up at some finite time, which I'm going to call Big Bang singularity for now. In fact, even before I reach that, they get so hot, which is like called Planck energy density, where my break equation and general relativity is breaking down. Because at so there is a regime which I expect with, if you go very, very high energy, then effects of quantum mechanics should be very important. I don't have a theory of quantum gravity. So what's the problem with that? So I have to end my theory somewhere here. But then I look at these things, and I see that if I track them back here, they were nowhere close to each other at that time. So how did they know about each other to produce the exact same power or temperature at this point? Well, the theory was breaking here, and they were not like close enough. Like it's like, you know, I don't know, me and someone else on the other side of Earth happen to buy exactly the same clothes, matching the same shoe, everything, in the exact same second or something like that. It just doesn't make, it's very, very unlikely coincidence, right? To do the same pattern where we didn't have time to even call each other or anything. So that's a big problem. So I have to come up with some scenario that not only makes these guys talk to each other, but also tells me how did actually even like, how did they, when they talk to each other, why did they decide to have this particular property of like power being the same? So then people thought about it in the 80s, and they came up with one scenario that's called inflation. So they realize if there is a particular kind of matter which is different from the ones that we are familiar with, different from radiation, which is called a scalar field, and I'll give you a little bit flavor of what it looks like, its action or things mathematically, then you can manage to keep the density constant, energy density, for a very, very long time, such that you have enough time to make sure these guys manage to get close to each other and talk to each other. And then, on top of that, it turns out this scenario can all exactly produce the kind of statistical property that we want, the scale invariance one, near scale invariance to be exact. So that was a big success. There were other alternatives that, for example, when I was a graduate student, there were cosmic string and other very beautiful, nice theories that could manage to do it to some extent, but they went out of the picture because of exactly as we were getting more and more of idea about the shape of this, they were not producing these peaks nicely. They were producing like a big white peak, so they became disfavored as time went on. But inflation managed to produce exactly that one. So that was a big success. Just let me mention here at this point this bounce, and then we can get back to bounce again. So later on, like, oh, maybe some people even back then realized maybe there is another resolution to solve this problem instead of introducing this particular time. And then one feature of this inflation, which I should say, is that what it does, it manages to make universe expand in time exponentially. So that's how it managed to keep this property. The other idea was like, what if instead of universe becoming smaller and smaller and so the energy density diverges and blow up, what if I can manage to stop the universe expansion? And as I go in past, obviously, stop it at some finite size and then make it become go the other way. So then it would be universe contracting phase, reaching some minimum size and then a starting expansion. That means the energy density would reach its some maximum, but not quite like Planck energy density where the theory breaks down. And then before that, because it was in the contracting phase, again, it would be universe bigger and bigger dilation of energy density. So then I also managed to buy a lot of time. I don't reach that problem of singularity. So in both cases, you manage to take away the singularity or time, make it much longer, and manage to have these guys communicate with each other. But we get back to that and its own problem later on. It's easier basically said than done. Okay. So give you an idea, flavor of the kind of things we have to do in order to achieve that story inflation. This new exotic kind of matter, scalar field, it's basically ruled by some like potential energy. This is called action. So this potential is always, there is a function that it has to have certain properties to produce the model, and it has like a kinetic energy, which you so this phi is what I'm gonna call my scalar field, and these are the notations in like general relativity and particle physics that you basically use to determine kinetic and potential energy. And in general, you can write the whole thing as a Lagrangian that depends on kinetic energy and the value of the field. And you go into like depends. So one of the problems, as you can see already, is that where does this exotic matter come from? We have to come up with a story for that. Until very recently, we didn't even have observed any scalar field in nature. There was one candidate, Higgs, and we only managed to see it, finally observe it, and confirm it a couple of years ago in LHC Large Hadron Accelerator. So that's the only one so far we have observed. So far we haven't observed any scalar field. But if there is one, then there is so much we can do with that, other ones. It's not very far-fetched. We are not completely crazy and just doing science fiction. The reason for introducing this kind of field is that it's the simplest kind. It only has 1 degree of freedom, one component that can do a lot. And we think a lot of fundamental theories, people who are doing quantum gravity and trying to do, like, for example, string theory, other things, this kind of fields show up a lot there. So it's not very far-fetched. For example, there are these models in string theory when you have extra dimension and the membranes that move, they're called D-brain, and you look at their actions, you do get things that look a lot like this.
Mm-hmm. Lagrangian mechanics in classical mechanics, can you tell me how you applied it here? Like, How are you using it here?
How do I use quantum mechanics, or?
Are you using Lagrangian mechanics in quantum mechanics?
Oh, in quantum mechanics. So basically this is kinetic term again, right? Kinetic energy, this is potential. Your job is to quantize both of these. This acts like a momentum, and this acts like, so what happens in quantum mechanics, you have one point particle and you quantize its position and momentum. When you move on to a scalar field, it's like a wave picture. So you have as if many waves or many particles that you have to quantize all of them. It's like a system of many harmonic oscillators. So you have to quantize, again, but similar story. You quantize momentum and you quantize the field. It's like, this is your position, this is your momentum. Does that make sense?
So how did you apply Lagrange mechanics in this?
Oh, it's the same story. You have to do the variation of action. I might have an equation of motion for you. So you vary with respect to delta phi. To get your equations. And so this is your basically variable. And have you done any variation or?
Any variation.
A variation of action. So Lagrange, if you want Lagrange equation, right?
Yes.
So Lagrange equation is applied when you, like, usually you have something like this, a variable. You have to vary it with respect to that. Assume this function is changing to get a Lagrange equation, and you end up, so if you have an L here, in general, like something like that, then you end up with something. So you get an equation. So you basically, this thing will vary with respect to phi dot, which is the time derivative of phi, and value of phi, and you get an equation. And that's your older Lagrange equation. That's what you were wondering? Yeah, it's actually, in classical mechanics, similar story. If you get that, very understand that, how to do the variation principle in classical mechanics, then the same thing exactly here. It's very simple to apply it. Okay? Okay, so yeah, we have, like, we think we have candidates from quantum gravity, which hopefully we'll hopefully know at some point. But at this point, that is sort of a puzzle. Like, do we have these fields? If we do, that's great. If not, it could be that it's like a effective way of parameterizing early universe in terms of just one component. But definitely, like, the form of the potential energy will play a big role. You can even have, like, as you see in this model, for example, the dependence on kinetic energy itself can be non-trivial and be different. And in fact, in cause, like, theories like a string theory, you might not have only one of these fields, you might have many of them which play a role.
Mm-hmm. So sorry, I'm not sure. Can you explain what a scalar field is? Like, what's the, because I'm not sure, I don't really understand the math.
It's like a wave. It's like a additional matter source in R. Like, we know we have, for example, electrons, right? Or protons. All of them have a Lagrangian of their own. Well, proton, nice composite, but like electrons or photons and things like that, right? And there are some, so in particle physics, and each of them, you can characterize them based on their properties.
Okay.
And there is a particular kind of particle, in a way, that you can add, whose properties we call a scalar because it's like basically it becomes a function of position, and we call that a scalar field. And but it's the same basically story if I had like a field like electromagnetism or things like that. It's just that its properties are like just a function, but fields can have directions and things. So then you have the Lagrangian with some kinetic term and potential. So this is basically another way. All you need to know is that for practical purposes, you can view it as some sort of fluid, some additional component in the universe, which has like a pressure and density. That's like practically that's what it does. Induces some matter component to your theories. And because it does that, then general relativity tells me that it will influence a space-time geometry. Again, you can write Einstein equation, everything similar to before, and the two are connected to each other. For example, if I assume that field only depends on time, it's uniform, it doesn't depend on a space, then I put the density here, calculate it, and then I can go and calculate how expansion is varying, Hubble is changing, space-times will be also uniform. But then if I have some anisotropies in this thing, delta phi, it will produce the curvature perturbation and gravitational fluctuation, the things that I want in order to produce CMB anisotropies and the thing that I'm really aiming at, seeds of large scalar structure.
Would it be possible to explain it without my analogy? Because I'm not sure what's going on.
So if I had, for example, electric field, right? Would you understand that it could give us some energy density or in our labs or things like that? Or
I understand, like, if the field lines are close together and it's high.
So if I have waves, what about waves? Like electromagnet, so there are, like, I know it's a little bit confusing, the pictures between particles and waves, but like if I, so what is radiation really? In particle view, you can say you have photons,
yep.
Right? But really mathematically, what we have, the photons, they are like basically electromagnetic waves. And there is energy hidden, like in these waves, that builds up, and the one that I can calculate, it, like when somewhere is hot, I can say there is an energy density due to the radiation in the, like, whatever box I have or something like that. But I can view it as energy density in terms of the waves, right? Same story here with the scalar field. It's basically same thing as I have some waves, and which I can characterize as a function. So it's basically a combination of waves, and therefore it gives us some energy and pressure. Does that make sense? And it has a potential energy of its own. So in the photon case, we don't have potential energy, but we only have the momentum and kinetic energy, something like. In this case, you have potential energy. And let me see, can I think of on top of my head a potential energy that, right, if you have a, what can I say, like if you have system of, I'm thinking of a springs maybe, right? That builds up potential energy. So if you have a system which is compressed, you would still assume there is some hidden energy, potential energy because of that. The same thing here, that potential also contributes some energy into your system. Does that? So now again, now it's a variation of this function will induce some curvature perturbation in generality.
Can you again explain the second one?
This one? So if it was just a uniform function?
The second one.
This one, yeah. So in the uniform one, just make the universe expand if I put them in Einstein equation. But now if I add, if it has some anisotropies, it's higher and lower certain point, it will make a space-time have like ripples and dimples and things like that. Because the two are connected to each other. One side of Einstein equation is geometry, and the other side is matter. If you have uniform on this side, you get uniform on that side. It will be a space-time is just like expanding itself, is just a uniform a space, but at the curvature is constant everywhere. But if you put ripples on this side, you get ripples on that side too.
What's the first symbol on pinpoint?
This one?
Yes.
This is the ripple in space-time, curvature perturbations. So it means that space-time gets crooked. Or like, does that make sense?
It's a function.
It's a function. It's basically another way of saying, again, remember, a space-time fabric is nothing but gravitation. Gravitational and curvature, all of these are the same. So in Einsteinian gravity, in Newtonian gravity, we characterize gravity as a force between two objects. In Einstein gravity, you don't do that. You say it's basically gravity. For example, if I have sun here, what it does, it curves the space, and that's why Earth goes around the sun, because of the space-time's geometry has changed, so it makes makes Earth wants to come here, but because it have a velocity, so it will keep rotating. So that's the basic, like, I guess, breakthrough of Einstein gravity, which managed to make us think of gravity instead of force as geometry. And that's why it is so hard to quantize it, because it's not a force really, it's kind of the fabric of the space-time.
What is that function equal to, like, magnitude?
What function?
That sine.
This one? Phi?
No,
this one? This one tells you basically what I was telling you. This ripples in.
Not exactly, like the curvature, the trajectory.
There is no trajectory. It just tells you if I have a space-time fabric, it will not be just like that. It will be some gravitational distribution in the, so instead of like the same way that sun makes a ripple in a space-time, there will be some ripples in early universe in the space-time, because that component of matter that I put in had some over-densities or less densities. It wasn't uniform.
I'm asking that if I put x equal to 2, let's say, and t equal to 3, what will I get? Like, is it?
You won't be. So you, all we can do is look at it as statistical properties. Well, we calculate that. Let's take a look at it and then we get an idea. I give you an idea. Let's do it. So the first one gives you acceleration, expansion, inflation. And the second one gives you exactly what I want. CMB, anisotropy, and large scale structure. This thing. Okay, let's give you some examples of so what goes in that component. So that potential that I told you, now you have many, many options in order to produce inflation. Maybe it looked like this. Maybe it looked like that. Maybe it was like this guy. So depending on fire starts here and goes down, you get accelerated expansion, inflation. Similar story here, similar story here, and then you can go and analyze how the momentum and field changes and so on. But then your question is, so which one was it really if it was inflation at early time? Now back to your term, how do I calculate these things? Very complicated, not easy. I'm just giving you a snapshot of the kind of math. You end up with some mathematical formulation, the variation of like these parameters which are related to how Hubble changes, then how change of the Hubble changes, and so on, gives you exactly the real, greedy details of the calculation. At the end of the day, you don't calculate zeta itself. You calculate some statistical property of it and give you some power. How much power is there in that curvature perturbation? It's going to be related to Hubble, for example, constant at that time, its variation at that time, and so on. And again, not only the power itself, you can go ahead and see how much power changed based on the scales. You measure that. And for example, last week, so this one is around 10 to the minus 9, we already knew. For example, now, last week we measured the variation of the power depending on the scale. It looks like it's very, it's like that, 0.96 with some error. So if it was exactly 1, it would be what I call a scale invariant, exact scaling. It's not quite 1, but extremely close to that. You see it's like about percent level deviated from that. And based on even that a small number, I can go back and test my theories of inflation, whether it was this one or that one or that one or whatever function. Uh-huh.
Go back to the case. I have some, I don't know the terms.
Yeah, you don't need to know. I'm just giving you a flavor. So, again, inflation is what I told you already. So, in terms of H, for example, or in density, as universe expands, basically inflation managed to keep the density constant at some point. So, all these scales come can manage to communicate with each other. So, this is distance. This is sort of A or expansion, doesn't matter, both of them as they increase. So if I was measuring something here and here on isotropy on different scales, now I have managed to make them both talk to each other. There is a little bit, again, uncertainty here. Did inflation start at some point? Did it go over forever in the past? What about that story? There are other measurements you can make. For example, there are similar stories that is, for example, if you had inflation, not only the temperature on isotropies, the one that I showed you would show up in CMB, we can produce some primordial gravitational wave. We can calculate the power in them. We can calculate how it varies in the scales. There are some predictions for that. There are other like predictions can have. So the statistical property that I was showing was called the so-called two-point function. There are additional statistical functions like three-point function. Can I measure that? Was this data, was it Gaussian distribution or was it slightly different from Gaussian statistics? So depending on how much information I can extract, I can pinpoint exactly which inflationary model fits the data better. Right, just give you a snapshot because it's cool. So the gravitational wave so far, and it's already been a major discovery itself, we have only seen it from compact object by LIGO, like emergers of compact objects such as supermassive black holes or neutron stars. So what we want for early universe, I'm looking for a smaller signal in primordial gravitational waves, the ones that are coming from very early time inflation. If we can manage to extract that, that would be a wealth of information, so much help to us to pinpoint what exactly happened. We had a bit of excitement a few years ago. We thought we managed to measure them. So this experiment, this telescope in South Pole, they were measuring the power spectrum in CMB, and they thought they measured, so there is a, because primordial gravitational waves managed to induce polarization in cosmic microwave background. So they are measuring polarization of photons on cosmic microwave background, which is very cool. And there is a special pattern. If it's due to gravitational wave, so they have to curve in a certain way, they go and extract it, and it's very, very small. Remember, like the temperature anisotropy themselves, 10 to the minus 5. And these guys are even like way like of order of magnitude less than that. So they have to go further down, and they thought on some scales, they are measuring it, and they announced it, and like everybody was celebrating. We had a big like celebration here at PI. And then it turns out astrophysics was not so kind to us. Data was contaminated probably by dusts in galaxies, intermedium. So they were inducing the exact same type of signal on cosmic microwave background. So this is probably wasn't primordial gravitational. But they haven't given up. So there are still more telescopes that are trying to go for this signal, do better measurement, can get rid of these contaminations to extract the primordial data. Okay, so without that, all we can do is, again, back to they're like something like Planck satellite. Again, this is from last week. The best measurement of that scale invariance that I was telling you, remember about 0.96, this is where they are. So we go and check these models of inflation one by one. What if the potential is phi squared? What is it phi to the 4.3? What if it's phi? Where would they sit? Like different kind of hilltop one, the one that was like looked like a hill. And we see, for example, let's see which one is which. Like this one, hilltop, is over here if you have that one. It can be probably here. And then we cannot measure primordial gravitational wave in the polarization of Planck yet. The best they can do, because they don't see it, to put some upper limit on it, that it has to be like less than certain level. So based on that, you can also limit which models you can have. So far, it's still a lot of like playroom. Many of them can fit in. So I cannot exactly say which inflationary model is better, but it's still like there is enough to do some work. Okay, so what then? So can I at any point with what I have the data falsify and say, for example, inflation was not the right theory of any early universe? It looks like with the potential, I can always like tune it no matter what the data is, such that it fits the data. So this is like more of a philosophical question. Is that a scientific way of doing understanding what happens in, is it satisfactory by itself? Like, am I achieving anything? I am adding a parameter and matching. No matter what nature tells me, I can manage to like put a parameter there and like change the function. So that's one like question that we need to answer. The other one was the elephant in the room, as I just mentioned to you. And this is related to the first one, because I don't know what in photon field is. I feel like it probably can come from quantum gravity or something, but we don't know. Then there is a story of what about the beginning of inflation? How did it start itself? if it has started, how do I manage to like at start it in the right way for the right time? There is a lot of like question about technicality of that. There is another problem with inflationary model called in eternal inflation, which is related again to initial condition. It's called eternal, which is basically if depending on where on the potential you start, you can end up in a completely different universe. And because they are exponentially expanding, you have this picture of there are like millions of billions of universe, each of them looking very differently. And how come like we managed to be in the right one that managed to produce the galaxies and the ones? So is this again like a philosophical question? If you have a theory that produces everything basically, is it the right theory or do I have to go back and think about that? Like, and then the singularity one, it seemed like in the cartoon that I showed you, like it, we managed to answer that because Planck, like energy density remained constant, so curvature was not really blowing up in the past. But there is more mathematics involved in that. There are people who are thinking, for example, maybe energy density is not in a way that you're looking at diverging, but if you really go back to the fabric of a space-time, look at the trajectories of particles, things like that, it seems in like if these observers, if they go further in past, space-time has an edge. So there is like mathematical technicality that doesn't seem like, it seems like inflation hasn't quite answered the singularity problem. So there is still that. Therefore, we just don't stop there. We try to go and explore other things, like maybe there are alternatives that work better than inflation. We haven't exploited all the options. We shouldn't just, you know, be satisfied with whatever we have. You know, like we have to do our best. So when should I end, by the way, Kelly? Should I?
So if you want to, we have until noon, but if you want to save some time for questions.
Okay, so I tell you a little bit about bounce as well.
Well, bounce theory, I've heard that there are problems with the second law of thermodynamics. Is that true?
Let's go there. Yes. So I didn't know how much details we can talk about bounce, but I tell you about that. So the bounce, as I said, the idea is that today, as we said, universe is expanding. Again, this is A. This is time, I'm here, I know universe is expanding, getting bigger. I'll go back in time, it must be smaller. So in the original story, it was going to zero, getting smaller, smaller. The idea of bounce is that sometimes in the further, in the far away past, it turns around. So universe basically was in a contracting phase. It was contracting, got to a finite size, and then bounced back. Right. And then the problem is that it's, as I said, it's not as easy. Because, let's see, can I come up with an intuitive way? So as you were saying, like there is a thermodynamical law. Right. How do I? Well, I knew that there was a good intuitive way to say this. So basically, we have to violate one of the main energy condition in general relativity. It's called null energy condition. So it tells you, maybe I can get it doing, do it here. So it tells you usually there is a relation between density and Hubble. The two are sort of related to Einstein equation. So if one is changing, the other one will change as well. So if rho is decreasing, I expect H to decrease as well. So if universe is expanding and getting bigger, then rho is decreasing, right? And so is H. Both of them are decreasing, right? Now, on the other hand, if I want a bounce here, A goes to minimum size and bound, you know about like doing derivatives, right? What is the derivative of A here in time? Zero, right? So A dot must be zero at the bounds. That means, remember the definition of H, which was A dot over A. So that must be zero there. So this was H going down as universe was expanding. At the bounds, it has to cross zero. So then somehow it must go back to zero, right? But this is again still like expanding. So this is bounce. After bounce is still expanding, this is contracting. So universe from here to here is getting big, but H is going up, right? So you have a box that is expanding, but energy density is going up, right? It doesn't make sense, right? So that goes back to that violation of energy condition that I tells you. When you do that, then all sort of, what is it, Pandora's box for worms opens up. We get what is called ghosts, instabilities, things like that. So you have to come with another theory, like it doesn't seem to work to get this thing bounced back. If we manage to do that, then we have to, again, do what inflation does, get the power spectrum, the anisotropy right, that itself is easier than said than done. Then again, your job is, so then what do you put in that does everything for you? Are we doing better than inflation? You have to face the same problems. Again, go back to this original picture. Let me remind you, that was the energy density. This was the good picture, good thing, that bounce is supposed to do this, so energy density reaches maximum, I'm going down. And solve that. But to do this thing, again, I have to answer some of those problems. So not, obviously, it's not completely hopeless. Therefore, me, Latham, other people are working on that to explore that option. So for example, the option I'm looking at, I'm introducing an exotic field. Again, don't ask me where it would come from yet. If I manage to do the bounce itself without instability, a scale invariant by itself, I have managed to do a lot. So the kind of, this is an interesting kind of a scalar field, similar to the before, except that its kinetic term has a square root. What I, we have realized like a long time ago with some collaborator was that this kind of exotic field is not really like a field on its own or component. It's like a parasite. It doesn't introduce any dynamics on its own. It, whatever you have in universe, it sort of goes around it and feeds on that. But what it does, it modifies all the equations of general relativity, which is a good thing, as I will tell you, because then I don't have to add something as strange that this does this thing for me and get rid of instability. Because this guy manages to do that, but the thermodynamical law, energy condition, those guys are done with the usual components of matter, so I don't have to deal with them. They will stay safe. So that's the idea. If on the face of it, when we first came across it, it looked like I have something that is traveling infinitely fast, which would be at odds with causality and everything. But then when we realized, oh, wait a minute, this is not a field or a matter field itself. It just modifies the equations. So it doesn't propagate and doesn't have, this looks like an artifact, but it's just because, this is an artifact of the fact that it doesn't have its own degree of freedom. And we called it Cascutan because of, apparently in Latin, the parasite called Cascuta. So, in fact, first we came across it and we didn't apply this to answer question about bounce or early universe. We used it for dark energy and late acceleration of the expansion. But now more recently, me and a couple of students, we looked into it. We managed to get a bounce. In fact, the one that I showed you, that A is exactly from our bounce scenario. it goes to minimum, comes out. Let's see. And then we looked at curvature perturbation very like quite extensively, looked at everything going through for the matter field. And we saw that there is no instability. Energy conditions for the actual matter fields are fine. So as you see, nothing is blowing up, going to infinities. So far we have shown you can manage to have a bounce without instability with this scenario. Now, what obviously is left to do is whether we can do this. That's the harder question. And that's what we are working on right now. Can I produce that with my model? Can I produce that? If I do, then maybe this is a good alternative to inflation. So that's where we are basically left with this inflationary model, bounce alternative options that we are exploring. But it's a good day to work in cosmology. Because on theoretical side, we have many puzzles that have to be resolved. And on observational side, we have many exciting experiments that are being planned and built. Like the BICEP one that I mentioned to you, now there are next stages of it that are being built. The Keck array, these are South Pole telescopes. These are in Chile. CMB experiments that are going for polarization exactly. We obviously have next, so you heard about LIGO, the next generation of gravitational wave probe, LISA, that will have much better handle on extracting gravitational wave from a space. Maybe we can get some information from that. This SKA, we are building, like not me, obviously, colleagues, are building these antennas in South Africa, in Africa, and the idea is with these tons of antennas, you can collect radio waves, and I think it's gonna be one of the hugest data bank of data that we will receive in future. And analyzing that will need a like huge kind of different range of skills, like machine learning, data analysis, and theorists working on that, and so on. So we are in an exciting time, because more observation is coming, and hopefully we can answer more puzzles about cosmology. Okay? Questions? Anything? Yes, go ahead.
What caused the slight variation in temperatures, like in the CMB?
Okay, so this story there itself is very, I think, neat. So let me bring up back maybe that. Let me see. Right here. So this anisotropies that I say, see here again, like at different scales, then I track them back and go, for example, in inflation scenario. They go back here and they still become, their wavelengths become smaller and smaller and smaller, such that when you reach further back, they become a very small scale when quantum effects become important. So the idea is that the vacuum fluctuations of this phi field originally will, because it has inherently a quantum field, if everything is quantum, then it will have some quantum fluctuations. And usually like this, like the variance of that quantum fluctuation, it won't be zero. It's very small, but it becomes bigger and bigger as many quantum effects as you go to a smaller and a smaller scales and higher energy. So therefore, at this time, it wasn't negligible. It was enough to print a little bit of fluctuation on that curvature perturbation.
But when, why wasn't it, you know, the bit of fluctuation everywhere? Why in those specific areas? Or is it just chance?
Oh, yeah, it is chance. So that's why I'm looking at variance and two-point functions, exactly. Because if I just look at that, then, so in fact, what you saw, like if I average the picture, right? Where was it? Yeah, like the Planck picture, for example. Right here. So the average just goes to zero and becomes like just delta T, or like, let's say, T, the temperature, the background, as I said, is 2.7 Kelvin, three. Now what we are measuring there is delta T over T. And some places it's higher, some places it's lower. If I average it out, it will go to zero. So it won't give me any information. But the variance of that will not, because even though it's somewhere hotter and somewhere positive, somewhere negative with respect to, so delta T is basically temperature minus this background temperature. So some places it's a bit hotter, some places it's a little bit lower. Some places it's a bit positive, some places negative. I average it, it would be zero. But when I do the average of a square, then it doesn't matter if it's negative or positive. It won't be zero anymore, right? That's why, in fact, we looked at two-point function or this variance. Because then, therefore, that will give us like some, and it has a specific form, it won't be. So if it was Gaussian noise, it would be different. If it was Poisson noise, so these are different statistical ways of characterizing. Does that make sense? Yeah, so it's random way. This is red and Y is blue. But therefore, it doesn't matter. It's the variance of the overall picture and a different. If I take a box like that or box bigger, when I say scales, that's what I mean, how you average it up. Mm-hmm. Yes?
You mentioned before that the dust can mimic the light. Oh, there.
Uh-huh.
So how do you know that that one is correct?
Oh, the anisotropy is here? So the dust changes the polarization, but you are right. There is a lot of like contamination on top of this too. I don't have the pictures, but that's a good, that's actually the hard work of our astrophysics colleagues to come up with the best way of describing different effects. For example, our own galaxy adds up obviously a lot of noise on this area because we are looking at it and in the frame of the Planck or satellites, galaxy looks like a plane or line here. So if you look at the original map, it will have lots of like blues and greens and things like that. So it's a job of like an astrophysicist to take that contamination out to get to this. Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to map these anisotropies to current large-scale structures in the universe?
Exactly, yeah, it is. So on...
Done?
It is done. In fact, there's a lot of things we can do with it. So remember, like I had a very older version of it. This is larger scale structure. Let me make it bigger. And you have to be careful. So let's see, it's not, the resolution is not very good. This is clusters. So I think this one is in Fourier space, sort of. This L is like angular, like harmonics. This one is real space. So this is what you do, is the same thing. You take, evaluate the variance of the distribution of galaxies and different matters and different scales. And these are different ones, observations. And then, obviously, if you go to very small scale, there's a lot of contamination because planet forms, like compact object forms, like there the connection has almost broken down. But when you do the analysis on very large scale, there is still a very good connection between this one and this one, except that it looks different because that one is in Fourier space, this one is in real space. But the fact that it matches this line is exactly the same as matching this line. And then there are other cool things that you can do. For example, you can cross-correlate the data from that to this one and extract more data about the evolution of expansion. In fact, that was one of the way to figure out that dark energy is important in late universe. Because, right, if you cross-correlate these two things, then on larger scale, you see some, they two are very connected to each other. Yes?
So assuming like that bounce theory or, yeah, is correct, what effect would it have for our predictions of the future?
Hard to say, because again, it's still like a lot of bounce theories have their own problems too. But some like generic feature, it seems like, again, remember that bicep predict experiment I said we were so excited about, because it has primordial gravitational wave. Inflation seems to predict more primordial gravitational wave than bounce theory. So if we, for example, see that, that might be a plus for inflationary models.
About bounce theory, doesn't it open the question of what was contracting in the first place before it bounced?
Yes, it does. Then you have to, again, yeah, definitely. It's a less, I guess, in a, depends on how you view it. You could hear it as a plus or minus. Because in inflation, then we are dealing very hot initial condition. In the other case, as you go further back, universe was again bigger and bigger and colder and colder. So cold initial condition, in some sense, is better and easier to handle.
With the bounce theory, does that mean that in the very far future, the universe is expected to contract again?
Depends on the model. There are some called, for example, cyclic models. Our director, for example, was one of them. That will happen in those models. It keeps bouncing back and forth. In my model, I don't expect it to happen. I just expect it to have one bounce. But yeah, it could possibly.
Are there any future experiments planned to have higher resolution on the CMB?
Yes, so not a big one like this all over universe, because I think we have extracted as much data we could on the mapping the whole space. But what we want to do is now better build up better ways to like have more resolution on a smaller scale, so extract like that. And that's what the other experiment that I was showing you, like the bicep, and that's because they become better at polarization. Easier to go through that, I guess. Right, these ones. Like this one, South Pole one, or there is Atacama, Advanced Atacama, I think this is ACT, and the next stages of the ACT are supposed to like zoom in and do better job and extracting polarization rather than going wide like Planck that is like, you know, sweeping the whole directions, just, you know, focus, be more focused.
So what are like the key differences between the inflation and bounce, other than the graph? Like the way you describe it makes it sound like there's not really much of a difference in the
way. Well, I mean, obviously for universe it matters a lot, right? Because one of them, universe started contracting and then bounced back. The other one, I didn't like, for example, that means universe just exponentially started exponentially expanding and then like a slowdown later when radiation and other things took over. So in that sense, it's very different. But obviously, the technicality will also be very different. Yes?
So under the bounce model, are there any explanations for why, like, instead of contracting and closing it on itself, it just like, bounce out?
Well, a successful bounce model better do that, right? It could have happened. In fact, that was one of the reasons we have instabilities, because a lot of them could not bounce back. So if you go towards a singularity, towards like getting contracted, you might end up with a big singularity as well. So that's part of the challenge. We don't want that because we want to come, like, explain our universe. Therefore, it better bounce back if you have a successful model. But there is definitely one of the challenges are that, like, you form, first of all, you form, like, deformed universes, things like that. A lot of the models face that problem. You have to overcome them in order for them to succeed.
I don't know if this is a really bad question.
No, nothing is bad question.
Remember that you love to call cosmological microwave background?
Uh-huh.
Like, why is it like the graph red and blue and stuff?
Just to make us understand better. In fact, I think I always confuse it myself. I think blue is hotter, red is colder, contrary to our expectation. If I remember right, I could be again wrong. So really, it's the color point is so you can see the variation. So again, so there is like the background temperature. It's around that. But how much different from that? It could be a slightly higher than that or a slightly lower than that. So based on whether it's higher or lower, they color coded so we can see the variation. So I think these blue ones are hotter, like slightly higher than 2.73, and the red ones are slightly lower, and then the other colors are in the middle. Like depending the darker it gets, it's hotter. The darker red is colder, so the difference becomes slightly. But again, remember this is extremely small variation.
Like what caused these small variations?
That field, like that's our job to explain. We think it either was inflation or bounce in originally. The quantum fluctuations in this guy mapped into the curvature perturbations, so ripples in gravitational field, and those one mapped into the temperature and matter later on.
Well, does that mean like the singularity theory is like incorrect? Singularity theory?
Singularity theory, it's definitely a problem. It's not that what it means is that right now, like our original theory definitely had a singularity. And it's not good to have a theory that something diverges in it, right? So we have to come up with something else that explains it. So definitely nature probably has a way of resolving it. We just don't know what that solution is.
I probably missed it, but how does the Bounce theory deal with the cosmological constant problem?
It doesn't. Yeah, so cosmological constant problem is a whole other problem on its own that we have to come up with a resolution for it. Yeah. Yes?
Is there a specific reason for the bias of experiment to be on the South Pole?
Okay, I'm reaching the edge of my observational knowledge. But let's see, I think it's one of the driest places in the Earth. And from atmospheric contamination, that's a good place to do the observations. The same thing with Chile. I think on the mountains of Atacama, there are also even though it's very cold and you would think there is snow and everything like that, but humidity exactly because it's so cold, humidity is really low. So for observational reason, it's a good place to set up telescopes.
Does the spin affect
That helps, but I think that's not the major because in the mountains you can also set your own. But obviously it helps how much coverage of a sky you get. If your aim is to have a wider range, that probably gives you a wider view. Mm-hmm.
How is it possible to see a CMB when it's say permanently hidden by a galaxy or something?
Yeah, so, right. So it gets, exactly, that's what I was saying. Like, it's, you have to come up with ways of understanding the radiation from our own galaxy and things inside the galaxies, and then clean up the map, take away all the contamination, and it's not easy. Like, that's why, for example, like, one of the big things early on was, like, these data are not public, but when they do put the public version, it's already cleaned up, because otherwise a lot of people like look at the original data and then go and do and see God knows how many like different models, which are just not right because there is so much noise in there.
So it's kind of like taking what you know is there, and then after that you're just like predicting the kind of effect.
It's like, you know, like real. If you look at like old photos or something, nowadays there are digital ways. If you know, like, there's good ways to clean up with image processing, things like that. So if, as long as you know, like, for example, how does different things act? For example, if you have ionized hydrogen in the middle, how would it change the map? If you have, like, stars or other things, how do you clean up for point sources?
But do we know how they act?
So that's the problem, right? So most, for most part, they do. But what BICEP, for example, experiment, the mistake they made was exactly because the dust contamination, they hadn't cleaned it up correctly, and there was effect in that that they hadn't taken into account.
So how do you know that that isn't happening for everything?
So, I mean, there is a lot of physics into it, and some of it you test for it. There is some always some systematic error that you can say, like, you know, this is the unknown version, so this is accurate. And there is probably, you see, like, the error bar. At least we think, like, to that level we understand the effects. And
so how does the balance theory refine our understanding of black matter and black energy, dark matter?
So at the end of the day, we have to deal with this jigsaw puzzle, right? So everything has to fit together in a nice way. So if I come up with any theory, it better not mess up this part or this part. So there is a good, if, for example, if I match this power spectrum nicely, that already has some ideas about how much dark matter could there be at early universe. But again, there is, to some extent, you have to also keep in mind that as you go further back in time, for example, matter evolves such as A to the cubed, or 3, to power of 3. But radiation is at A to the 4. So radiation becomes more important. So I better, like, it's like you have some leverage on which effects are more important. But obviously, when you fit everything together, you have to make sure everything, like, you don't put a theory here that mess up something here, right? But you have, you get an idea, like, okay, if I, you know, I come up with a theory on larger scale for dark energy, it probably won't mess up my experiment today in optics today in the lab, right? So you get an idea how much you have to worry about what effect to effect, whatever. But that is the same thing with quantum mechanics, right? Newton didn't know, like, quantum effect, but he still managed to write the laws of classical mechanics, even though it had to fit the quantum mechanics. He didn't know about it, but it did. It's just that quantum effects were not important for his theory, right? So, but at the end of the day, we know that the quantum mechanics and classical mechanics have to be consistent with each other. But there are people who come up with theories that try to connect this one or with that one. It's a harder job to do, like, answer 3 questions with one model than answer 3 different ones that fit together.
You might have explained that already, but remember the graph where there are 2 lines going down and there's
Right.
Yeah, like, what has those 2 lines, this 2 linear line mean? Because
that was really... So, here, right?
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, I was thinking if I measure the statistical properties on some, like, let's say 100 megaparsec, and then a statistical properties on 500 megaparsecs, something like that. And then, but then these were the distances, for example, here from each other. If I go further back in time, then this, because universe was a smaller and a smaller, that 100 megaparsec would have been a smaller distance, and similarly this, they would get closer to each other. But still, like in this plot, I'm not, I guess, plotting, I'm just saying them, they're going down, and this one becoming a smaller. But they're still, at some early time, they're going to be separated from each other. If it was, because, and this one is saying energy density as the universe was a smaller, becoming larger and larger.
Mm-hmm. If you measure wavelengths before, that are longer than infrared, longer than microwave, would we be able to see a picture of the universe at an older stage, at an earlier stage?
Not with that. It doesn't matter how much infrared in radiation or the basically electromagnetism spectrum. That's the, because it universe becomes opaque after that. The photons just get scattered so fast before that. So keep in mind, like, I'm going back and back. Right now, photons are freely traveling between galaxies almost to good extent. But they are like, the distances are such that they just come to me, as from this light can come to me. There is like sometimes some effects on top of it, but it's, I can take care of it. But I go back and this becomes denser and denser and denser, and matter becomes denser, hotter, hotter, right? And they get mixed up to each other. So you get to a point where the universe, before that, it's like a very hot soup that, you know, the electrons are here and the photons here. No matter which direction they move, they are hit by an electron or some hydrogen atom, and they cannot just, you know, come cleanly out. So that's why everything before that, it's like an opaque surface. I cannot see through it. It's just after the universe expands, becomes big enough, such that the distances of these are large enough such that photons now can freely travel to me, that I can then see the picture. But there is an idea, for example, again, if we get to do gravitational wave, they were not interacting with electrons and hydrogen. Similarly with neutrinos, maybe they can come and we can see through that. Uh-huh.
Question, what are the dark ages?
So the question, dark ages means right now all the lights that we see, like basically, but there is the radiation of the photons, but aside from that, everything else was not, like there was no star or anything, nothing bright in that time. There was a period until the first stars were produced, and then they managed to radiate some bright. Yes?
We'll take one last
one last question. Okay.
How does radiation work in the early universe?
What do you mean by work?
Like, how does it contribute to dynamics of the universe?
So, it's like there is an era here where it becomes, so here matter is mostly important. I can give you, so density. For matter, let's say if I had a fixed mass, would be mass divided by V. Let's say V is proportional to length, so I have L squared, L cubed. Each L is expanding like A, so this becomes M divided by some constant A cubed, right? Therefore, density, as A goes smaller and smaller for regular matter, goes as A to the minus 3. So it becomes larger. That's for matter. But for radiation, it's the same thing, almost, like heuristically. You have the A cubed here. But the energy of photons itself will also depend on their wavelengths. So there is a 1 over, so it's proportional the frequency, so you get a 1 over A from here as well. So it becomes proportional to the 1 over A cubed from here, but another 1 because of the frequency will also change. The energy will depend on that, so it becomes A to the minus 4, proportional to A to the 4. Therefore, when we go further back in time, at some point, A becomes a smaller and smaller. This function wins over this one. So radiation is important in some area around here. It determines how H is changing or things like that.
So does radiation like expand the universe, or like what does it actually do?
It makes it expand, yes, at this early time. But then it becomes subdominant to the matter because matter starts to become more important. As A becomes smaller, this function wins over that function. Make sense? Okay.